This is On the Record with Gavin Riley, with you until 1 o'clock this lunchtime here on News Talk. Lots to come up on the show between now and 1 o'clock, but we'll start with always with a quick browse of the Sunday papers. I'm joined remotely from different parts of the world by Gráinne Long, who's the former chief executive of the ISPCC in Childline. She is now the Commissioner for Resilience with Belfast City Council. And I'm also joined by Ian Power, who's the chief executive of Spunout.ie. I'll talk to them in just a minute. But firstly, what's on the front pages of this morning's newspapers, starting with the Sunday Times. Cabinet divided over Leaving Cert exam acts. At least three ministers, including Charlie Flanagan, Josepha Madigan and Michael Creed, argued against cancelling this year's Leaving Cert exam when the cabinet met on Friday. But reports from the National Educational Psychological Service, or NEPS, on stress levels among students, and from the State Examinations Commission on the extreme difficulties in staging it safely, convinced the government to go ahead with calculated grades instead. Amid speculation that the new system could face legal challenges from those who miss out on university places, the Department of Education stressed yesterday that students will have three chances to nail down the college course or apprenticeship of their choice. First is the calculated grade, second is an appeal to try and increase that grade, and third is the possibility of taking a written exam in November. And students who use calculated grades to take up a college course will be able to change to a higher points course next year if they can improve their exam standing when they take the actual exam. Their entitlement will not be changed. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times, lockdown will mean 1,800 extra deaths from cancer. This is an estimation that as many as 1,800 people could end up dying from cancer over the next 12 months as a result of the curtailment of services arising from COVID-19. And also on the front page of the Sunday Times this morning, a member of the Green Party's negotiating team says he would have a problem being part of a government that includes the likes of Michael Lowry, Dennis Nocton and Noel Grealish. That's Oisin Smith, who's a Dunleary TD for the Green Party. The front page of the Mail on Sunday, safety fears for back to work commuters. This is a follow on from yesterday's publication of the government's back to work strategy, which was published yesterday. They say that major safety doubts have been raised over the government's strategy to get the nation back to work. The set of rules which employers will have to implement to ensure staff can return safely was announced yesterday by Business Minister Heather Humphreys. But crucially, the plan did not include protocols for safety using public transport, leading to questions as to the viability of the plan. The Mail on Sunday has learned that the government is formulating a plan that will advise passengers to wear face masks and continue to keep socially distant while in public transport. But last night, the opposition were questioning how public transport could possibly have the required capacity to ferry workers, which could lead to return to work gridlock as commuters choose the safety of their cars instead. The front page of the Business Post this morning, warning over lockdown relaxation as test results continue to be delayed. This is something which no doubt we'll be talking to Killian de Guskin about in the next hour here on The Record. But Susan Mitchell tells us this morning that doctors and patients across the country continue to experience delays in getting COVID-19 test results, creating obvious risks as lockdown restrictions are eased in the coming weeks. GPs have said that while patients are now being offered same day or next day appointments for their samples to be taken, a significant number are still waiting a week and longer for the results. And this is despite assurances that results would be forthcoming within 3 to 4 days by now, and amid calls from experts for the turnaround time to be improved to as short as 24 hours. Also on the front page of the Business Post this morning, the maker of the world's dearest drug seeks approval in Ireland. The National Centre for Pharmaeconomics has instituted a rapid review of Zolgensma. I hope I pronounced that right. It's a 2 million euro drug for a rare and often fatal genetic disease. It's manufactured by Novartis. It's a gene therapy medication for patients with a particular type of spinal muscular atrophy. Many of those who are affected don't live beyond 2 years of age. It comes with a price tag of about 2 million euro for one intravenous infusion. Novartis has said that the price is justified because the therapy can bring lifelong benefits. That's the Business Post. And finally for now, the front page of the Sunday Independent, a pretty bold headline. Reality bites. Watchdog warns on tax hikes and pension age as the recession kicks in. This is based on an interview with Sebastian Barnes, who's going to be taking over as chair of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council. He says the next government is going to have to consider hiking taxes, and it's going to have to consider spending cuts to deliver an economic recovery. That is because unemployment is now close to 30%, and the cost of the state's employment measures is now at over 13 billion euro and rising. But this is apparently his advice, that they were going to have to reconsider the very risky proposal to keep the pension age at 66, and we'll also have to look at increases in property and inheritance taxes as part of the talks on forming a government. So that is your guide to what's in this morning's papers. As I said, I'm joined by Ian Power, who is the chief executive of Spunout.ie. He's in Dublin. But first to Belfast, to Gráinne Long, who is now the Commissioner for Resilience with Belfast City Council, former chief executive of the ISPCC. Gráinne, good morning to you. Obviously, you have a different panoply of front pages in Northern Ireland as well, because the UK is looking at potentially following Ireland's lead in publishing its roadmap this evening. What's the state of play there?
That's right, Gavin. Good morning. Yes, so today is it's a big moment in a way for cities across the UK and for people in our households sitting waiting to hear from the Prime Minister. And it's been coming for quite some time now, a plan to start the strategy of return to so-called normality, and that will, we hope, include a number of things. So it has to include, obviously, an approach to return that focuses on safety, on health and safety, and giving people a sense of confidence in terms of return and the ability to think about how they start to live their lives again. But I think what's also really important is how they balance that the health and the safety aspect with the economic recovery. And then obviously there will be a number of people also saying how short, medium and long term does this plan need to be, because the economy has changed and it's changed fundamentally. So therefore, do we use this as an opportunity now to restructure our economy? So very similar in many ways to what's happening in Ireland and what's happening in countries globally, all of the same questions being posed. And I guess that's really one of the lessons for all of us in terms of the pandemic, is that it has been universal. It has affected us differently in different countries and different cities. But really, the questions that are being asked in terms of exit strategies and recovery strategies are the very same questions. How do you keep people safe? How do you build public trust and public confidence in our system so that they feel safe and they feel their children and vulnerable people are safe? And then how do you bring the economy back in a way where we learn lessons from previous crises?
Do we know anything about whether that plan, because it will presumably apply to all four corners of the United Kingdom, will there be any sense of cross-border cohesion in that plan as regards how it applies to Northern Ireland, and whether there is the risk of perhaps the North and the Republic being slightly at odds in this?
Well, certainly up to now, there's been a huge amount of similarity across the four UK jurisdictions, and very much in lockstep in terms of their approach. I think it's probably too early to tell, and I think the messaging coming out from all of the countries over the last few days has been that that will remain the same for now. And while there has been occasions where the First Minister in Scotland and the First Minister in Wales have made announcements in advance of the UK, of London government and Westminster, those announcements haven't been very different. So it's been, I suppose, more about, I imagine, those first ministers wanting to speak directly to those, you know, through their own press, through their national media, to the people in their own countries. And so more about that and less about a change. For now, I don't expect any change. I would expect that the four nations in the UK and four jurisdictions in the UK will keep closely together. And part of the reason for that, I imagine, is any changes that do emerge, very similar to Ireland and other countries, you take a step, you test it, you see if it's worked, and then you move on. So it doesn't feel for the moment like divergence, that there's a strong logic for divergence. But let's wait and see.
Let's wait and see, indeed. I do notice this morning with some bit of amusement that Harry Cole, who's the deputy political editor of the British Mail on Sunday, he says that British ministers this morning are raging because on paper they're supposed to be meeting later to discuss their 50-page roadmap on the virus fight. But Boris Johnson's already recorded the message. He sent the document to the printers and he's basically made all the decisions. The people are wondering what's the point of even dialing into the cabinet meeting, which sounds very familiar to some of the concerns that Irish ministers had on the front pages of the Sunday papers last week. Ian Power, Chief Executive of Spunout.ie, you're elsewhere in Dublin this morning. Good morning to you. We will talk a little bit later in more depth about the leaving cert, but is there anything for now that jumps out at you from the newspaper coverage about what the government has decided?
Yeah, I think the main thing really is just that the TUI just calling for particularly the measures to deal with parents. And it's quite an interesting piece as well, written by Colm O'Rourke in the Sindo, just talking about the two words that he would have for parents. And he said the second word is off. So I think that will be a particularly challenging thing over the next couple of weeks. And I know just from talking to teacher colleagues that their WhatsApp groups were very anxious on Friday, just in the anticipation of dealing with parents and dealing with the pressure that they are now going to be under to give, I guess, fair grades, but also as well, I think, you know, they're asking for, you know, parent involvement to be removed from this process and some sort of sanction. And that's in the TUI calling for that on the front page of the Sunday Times. I think another positive as well that's noted in that front page piece is just that the IOA are saying that, you know, for the 4,000 UCAS applicants applicants, this is good news in that the deadline for feeding in the grades to the UK system is August 31st. And so it looks like we're going to be on track in order to do that for those 4,000 students, which is positive. But I know we'll talk about it in more depth shortly.
Yeah, I know that some officials were also saying on Friday that Joe McHugh had been in touch with his British counterparts and with his counterparts in the other devolved institutions around the UK to try and have some amount of flexibility, that if it turns out not to be possible to produce the predictive grades by the end of August, that maybe UCAS could basically throw us a little bit of latitude to try and give us an extra couple of days to get it over the line. But as you said, we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail a little later this hour. But first, I want to bring in Professor John Fitzgerald. He is the chairperson of the Climate Change Advisory Council. He's also the former head of macroeconomics at the ESRI. John Fitzgerald, good morning to you. We wanted to pick your brain because, as we can see in a lot of today's papers, there is some big concern around, firstly, how even in the normal course of business, the state is going to fund itself for the foreseeable future, given the scale of what COVID-19 is going to cost us. But then when you factor in the costs of moving towards a slightly lower climate society, it seems that all those costs are going to pile up pretty quickly, doesn't it?
I think that there are going to be problems in that we're going to spend 30 billion or more dealing with the current crisis. And 30 billion would have bought you subsidies for electric car, a million electric cars, and it would have retrofitted 30-40% of houses on the island by 2030 if you had that budget. So it's money that has been spent to keep the show on the road, which will not be available. So I think that the constraints are going to be there. I think we need to find the money to do what's necessary, but we need to do it in a very efficient way when tackling climate change.
So does that mean then that a lot of the big picture things that would have been open to any new government, in your view, are now no longer attainable because of how much money has been borrowed just to keep the lights on for this year?
I think that a major expansion of investment in the future will require a major expansion of taxation. I think that it will not be possible to go out and to continue borrowing large sums of money beyond probably 2022. So we have to balance the books. Now, we also have to tackle climate change, and there are things which are cheap, which should be done up front, which will actually save money. And then there's major investment like in public transport infrastructure, the benefits of which in terms of climate change and society generally will come towards the end of the decade. Mm. But we need to do those if we are to produce a society that is both sustainable and livable in the future.
Well, I'll talk to you about what you think some of those shorter term options might be. But first of all, I want to play you some audio from Patrick Conaghan, the former governor of the Central Bank of Ireland. He was speaking this morning with Vincent Wall on Taking Stock inside the last hour here on News Talk. And he commented a little bit about the budgetary and taxation concerns that the forthcoming government will have to look at.
It's quite likely that governments will decide to increase tax rates on, I'd say, in particularly income tax in years ahead. They probably will do that because there will be an increased public demand for services. They will not be satisfied with cutbacks. Healthcare will be right in the, you know, highest dimension. The issue is we're using up the leeway that could have been used to do substantial structural changes and improvements in the economy. I'll give you an example. The issue in healthcare was the movement towards slanted care, the movement towards possibly a single tier instead of a double tier system, and an awareness that that would involve a one-off startup cost of several billion euros. The availability of borrowing headroom to do something like that is being eroded with the borrowings that we're making now. Similarly, climate change, as we're pressed to make adjustments in the whole structure of our economy, very costly upfront costs. Again, the leeway is being eroded. And also, when you have, as we will end up with, a very high debt ratio again, you're in a more vulnerable position for the next crisis or problem that comes along.
Patrick Conaghan, the former governor of the Central Bank, speaking to Vincent Wall on Taking Stock inside the last hour. The full podcast of that is available to listen back on newstalk.com or through the Newstalk and Go Loud apps. He was raising the prospect there, John Fitzgerald, of an increase in income taxes and also concerns around the investment you need for sláintecare care and indeed for climate change. So to go back to your original point, what are the short-term, relatively cheap investments that you could make to try and get some sort of meaningful climate action off the ground? What can you do now, given that we're constrained by the finances elsewhere?
All right. In the agricultural area, changing the fertilizer that we use to an alternative kind of fertilizer, which results in lower emissions, would save 500,000 tons out of the 60 million tons that we emit in terms of greenhouse gases, and it would cost very little extra. So there are easy wins in the agricultural area, if and they should be implemented rapidly. But there are other areas we should look at in terms of, are there cheaper interim solutions in terms of houses? Like if we banned smoky coal and turf burning in cities, that would actually improve health significantly, and it would reduce emissions. It would be relatively small. Shifting from oil boilers to gas boilers in cities, shifting in rural areas from oil into biomass, wood chips or whatever. There are a range of things which we need to look at, which will make a difference, not huge, but which are cheap to do. But we still will need to find the money to make the major investments in land use change, in terms of public transport across a range of areas. And as Patrick said, and said exactly what I said earlier, there are less resources around in terms of borrowing. So it is likely that we will have to raise taxation over the coming decade to fund all the things we want to do.
So to that extent then, do you agree with the comment from the incoming chair of the Fiscal Advisory Council this morning that it's simply just not possible to have your cake and eat it, to defer increases in the pension age or to defer a lot of other measures, to rule out the idea of personal income tax increases, because all of them, in your view, perhaps will be needed?
We have to find the resources to do what we want to do through taxation from 2022 onwards. And it is, we can prioritise, we can do these things. We will need higher taxes. We can do some of them, but not all of them. And then there's a lower increase in tax burden. But we are facing a rather different world from the last 5 or 7 years, where taxes have, the talk have been of tax cuts and improvement in services. We're going to face a world where we're actually going to have to see some increase in taxation if we want to improve our services.
And to your mind, is that completely non-negotiable? Is there any way that a government can start to bridge deficits of 30 billion this year perhaps, or of 10 or 15 billion next year, without doing something that hits ordinary people in their pocket?
Well, I think this year and next year, the government is right to borrow. And they'll end up borrowing 30 billion or a bit more. And that is sustainable. And partly because we, the people of Ireland, are saving like mad. So essentially, the government has, a lot of their borrowing will come in directly from households. But it is when we go back to normal and we want to spend and have our holidays and eat out and do these things, we won't be saving, and the government will have to find the tax revenue, because otherwise, if you don't balance the books from 2022 onwards, you're borrowing from abroad. And why should other people fund one of the richest countries in the world? So I think from 2022 onwards, you're looking at balancing the books. But this year, and there are going to be continuing costs next year, the sorting out this mess. And there would be substantial borrowing next year. But that means that you have to go back to balancing the books thereafter.
Yeah, sounds like there's some pretty difficult decisions ahead. John Fitzgerald, thanks very much for your time this morning. Good to catch up with you. That's Professor John Fitzgerald. He's the chairperson of the Climate Change Advisory Council, and he's the former head of macroeconomics at the ESRI. Gráinne Long and Ian Power are still with us on the line. Gráinne, your thoughts on what you've just heard from John Fitzgerald?
Yes, I mean, so I think there's no doubt that a restructured economy is ahead of us. But I think there's a number of things that I would just want to offer some suggestions on. I mean, the UK, for example, we have to, so it's now written in law that we have to arrive at a net zero carbon economy by 2050. So what does that actually mean? It means in our lifetime, in the next generation, we have to completely change how we live our lives, and we have to reduce our dependency on carbon. But that sounds costly, and it sounds, you know, like we're all going to have to make huge sacrifices. Actually, when you look at the data and you look at the information and you look at what other countries have done, there are huge benefits. There are societal benefits. There are economic benefits to us. So that's some of the work that we're doing in Belfast, is thinking as a city, given that we have to start this work now in this decade. We can't afford to lose the next 2 years and not take the steps that we need to take. So we're looking at housing and we're looking at transport, and in particular in housing, and John did mention this at the start of the interview, there are some quick wins available to us to start to retrofit our homes right now. And fundamentally, many households spend too much money on energy, on carbon-based fuels, because their homes aren't energy efficient. So you're turning on your fire, you're turning on whatever it is you're turning on, and the heat's going out through the roof, out through the window. So we need to start retrofitting our homes. What does that look like in practice? It means, first of all, jobs for trades and tradespeople who are going to need those jobs. It means investment in supply chains on this island. It means then fewer, lower heating bills. And it also means moving away from our dependency on fossil fuels. Because what does that mean? It means you're dependent on a global energy system, and you just don't want to be doing that. We're too exposed in that sense. So we can increase our resilience as a city and as cities. We can reduce our energy bills, and that means more money in people's pockets. And we did, there was a piece of work done in Belfast back in 2010 after the last financial crash, which found that investment in retrofit of 100,000 homes yields 2,300 jobs, huge supply chain implications, and reduces our carbon. So there are real wins here. And I think, you know, this is now a moment where we really need to think the stimulus, the money that we're going to borrow, you only get that once. And if we invest it in the right way, then there are real opportunities to tick two boxes at once, to start to meet our decarbonisation targets, to start to wean us off carbon, while at the same time creating jobs and boosting the economy and making an impact on society.
Yeah, I think so. It just requires a certain amount of imagination, doesn't
creative. It? It does, but it also requires us to look elsewhere. There are cities. So if you look at cities like Copenhagen, which many of us who are lucky enough to be able to have travelled in the last few years, they used the last financial crash really creatively as a city, and they started out after the financial crash thinking, how do we want to change the lives of our citizens and our residents? And that's why when you go to Copenhagen now, most people cycle to work, and they're a decarbonized economy, and it's a lovely place to live. They do pay very high taxes for that, but they have restructured their economy. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility. And I think we have to use this moment now as cities to think very differently about what the next 10 years needs to look like.
Before I go to an ad break, Ian Power, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree with what Gráinne is saying, and to build on her point, like, time is ticking on. And if you read the Sunday Times editorial today, they're talking about an annual average of 7.6% in Ireland in terms of our emissions between now and 2030. If we have to have any chance to kind of limit the temperature increase to that 1.5 degrees Celsius. So I think, you know, if you look at this opportunity that we have now, there's another piece in the paper talking about greenhouse gases could fall by more than 7% just due to the fact that we're not traveling as much in this kind of 2 month period, and the time that will be left in lockdown. So I think people, when you look at the conversation that's happening online around commuting, the piece around public spaces, around the Phoenix Park, College Green, being able to cycle, and those emission reductions, I think people are not going to tolerate the old way of life. And I think people are going to look at the climate agenda, not just through the lens of a need to be responsible towards the planet, but also the possible quality of life improvements that can come with it.
Gráinne, I want to go back to one of the points you were talking about just before our last ad break, and that is the idea of perhaps redesigning how city life works, or how a lot of people commute into big urban areas. And the front page of the Mail on Sunday raises a sort of a pertinent point that there's a big safety fear now for commuters going back to work, because obviously public transport is going to have to enforce physical distancing for a while. That's going to mean they're going to be operating even at full pelt with a dramatically reduced capacity. And you've an issue there now where, at a time when we're trying to encourage people to be more environmentally mindful, you could have the economy getting back to sort of medium capacity, and yet the vast majority of people won't be able to use the public transport that they may previously have done. So we're going to become even more reliant on cars in the short term.
Yes, that's the big risk. So this is going to take really, really careful planning. And again, when you look at cities in the Far East and cities that are ahead of us in terms of the cycle, we absolutely have to learn from them. So Belfast is part of a network of cities. This week we launched an open global platform, Cities for a Resilient Recovery. And that's hundreds of cities globally, all sitting, talking to each other, learning from each other. And I have to say, I was on a call last week, 15 different cities, San Francisco in the US and a number of other global cities. Nobody has an answer yet on transport. So there is no easy answer to this. And my view is that this is going to take a cyclical approach. So I think we're going to have to encourage people who can walk and who can cycle to do so. We're going to have to give them incentives. We're going to have to make it as attractive as possible. And we're going to have to give people lots of space. There will probably be staggered returns to work in terms of times of the day. So that will help. That will free up space and time for people who, for whom walking and cycling isn't an option. And those people need to view public transport as a safe option. So that's where public trust is really important. And we do need to think about the design and the functionality of our public transport and our buses and trains, depending on what city you live in and the types of transport that's available to you. And I think, you know, it also means, and this is my own personal view, it does mean being really clear to people that the cars over time will be the exception rather than the norm. And when you look again at what other cities have done and how they've done that, you don't do it overnight. It does require quite a bit of creativity and risk taking. And I think we've seen that now from governments globally, more open to trying things out and testing things and piloting. Some of the things that we've introduced that have been introduced by governments globally, we've redesigned our cities in a few days to do things that would have taken 10 years. So I think we need to start taking some risks in relation to this. But you know, systems change, hate that technical term. It's not an easy thing to do and it will require planning, but it does require bringing the public with you. And that's where I think we need to have a public involved. And I think, you know, engaging with and consulting the public and constantly asking them what's working for them will really help. And the cities who have done this well do it at a very place-based local level. Not everything can be centralized. And I think that's one of the areas, I think, in the UK where we have to learn from other countries. When you take centralized approaches to things like place-based, how people get around, how you get to see your parents who you're worried about, how you get to work and home and pick the child up, all of those day-to-day challenges for people that are going to be with us for a long time. Government can't tell people how to do this. We have to do it with people and we have to involve them in those decisions.
Ian Power, I suppose this is something that we've seen a little bit of adjustment on in cities like Dublin, but also in Cork, Limerick, Galway, Waterford to a degree as well, taking temporary measures like, for example, closing off some permanent car lanes and turning them into bespoke cycling lanes or public spaces for the short term. Is that the sort of thing that really should now be made permanent so that when the world gets back to some sort of normality, they just have to live within those parameters? Or is there still a need to try and keep the old system as it was for a little while?
No, I think we have to grasp this opportunity while people are in this moment to obviously in the immediate term make changes because of the physical distancing requirements, but in the longer term try to maintain the switch to really only commuting into urban centres if we absolutely have to and if we can't do the work that we're required to do from home or from some sort of regional working hub. So, you know, we've seen those spring up in the west of Ireland and the southwest of Ireland where you go to a kind of a hub where you're working with employees from all different companies together in the one space, rather than feeling this need that everybody has to travel into the centre of Dublin in order to be productive. I think a lot of people are going to rethink the commute over the short term if they are expected to start making those, you know, sometimes 2-hour round trip, maybe up to 4-hour round trips into Dublin city centre or other urban centres around the country. There's been pieces from fathers who are saying that they're only realising because of this break from having to travel into the office how much of an absent father they are and all of these different things. Like it really does make a huge difference to the quality of people's lives. And I think one of the key things to enable, I think I note the headline in the piece in the Mail on Sunday is that the commuting strategy in the immediate term will be based on working from home. But we have to remember that a lot of people are working from home under huge stress and duress with kids around the house at the moment, and childcare and figuring that out in the immediate and into the longer term will be hugely important to being able to make sure that working from home or working outside urban centres is going to be something that's possible. And an interesting piece in the Sunday Times as well points that, you know, they're looking at there's a 20% decline potentially in energy use just due to the lack of office occupancy. That's from the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland.
Do you think
though
businesses will suck that up forever though, Ian? Because everyone is like dealing with the reality that we're in right now and nobody can go to the workplace and everyone is at least trying to do what they can from home. But I'm not as convinced that employers will suck this up forever, that they're always going to think that there is slightly lesser output or constrained capacity, or that if they're only getting so much done that maybe they could do it with fewer bodies. I don't know if people will see this as the sea change we're making it out to be.
No, I don't think it's going to be a panacea, and I definitely agree with you. I think there will be skepticism. And however, I think this is a very useful experiment. I think up to now, employers were looking at the cause for more work from home, for the 4-day week, all of these different things, and viewing them with, you know, heavy dollops of skepticism. Whereas, and I think the public sector actually will have to take a leadership role in this, because, you know, I know a lot of public sector colleagues, and a lot of their work is output based, and they're actually finding that the output has increased dramatically, and I'm talking 20% more since this has started, in terms of the number of things that they're able to progress out of the system. And that's not just working longer hours at home or anything like that. That's just based on the normal 9-to-5. So I think the public sector will have to look at, you know, how has this been? Has it really impacted productivity? I would say it hasn't. But obviously, you need to have the data to be able to base those decisions on. Where it hasn't impacted productivity, we need to be able to lead and have those workers continue to work from outside of urban centres. And I think that the public sector is obviously such a huge employer that that could be a very positive first step, and give, I guess, confidence to other companies that they can follow suit and they can follow the same. I think there's a really interesting piece in The Economist this week just about, you know, whether this is the death of the office or not. They don't conclude that it is, but I do think that employers will have to take a look at this and really evaluate in a very sensible way based on data whether or not their concerns about trusting people to actually do the work from home were founded or unfounded. And I would argue that they were unfounded.
Yeah, maybe we need to at least give them the benefit of the doubt and to figure out the appraisal of all of this when all of this is over and they have the option of maybe having either or. All of this, of course, feeds into the ongoing question of government formation. And we know that the Green Party is obviously pursuing very keenly an agenda against trying to reduce carbon emissions. But as we were talking, growing with John Fitzgerald, and you would have heard Patrick Honohan make the point as well, a lot of these big picture things are going to be very difficult to achieve given the financial constraints that we're in. That if, for example, you wanted to double train capacity or quadruple the number of people on buses, that's a huge capital outlay at a time when perhaps more than ever the state can't really afford it.
So I think there's a number of things there. First of all, I think it's going to be very, very important that we are clear about what we're trying to achieve in the short, medium and long term. And I think at every recession, and unfortunately it is the case that we all remember only too well a decade ago, the big, big decisions that were taken in Ireland and the UK and across Europe. And some countries and some cities really use that opportunity as a moment to restructure their economy. And I think we need to now think again and think, what do we need to change, and how quickly can we change that over the short, medium and longer term? I'm not sure I entirely accept the point that we don't have the money to do all of this. We have the ability to borrow, which has already been said. That borrowing needs to be invested in multiple problem solvers. In other words, we don't have the luxury anymore to say some money going here and some money going there. And we need to try and find investment solutions that will solve several problems at once. And that's why, as I say, things like retrofit of homes does more than just invest in housing. It generates and boosts supply chains, and it reduces energy bills, and it puts money straight back into the economy. And it's potentially a recyclable form of stimulus. So we need to be finding more of those kinds of ways to invest and some of those sources of stimulus. I wanted to mention actually a really good report that was published this week by Nicola Stern, so the famous Stern report, Joseph Stiglitz, global economist and well-renowned. And they concluded, so they looked at 700 different types of stimulus policies globally. They conducted a global survey of 231 experts, including finance ministries and central banks. And they concluded essentially that green stimulus will generate more in terms of economic output and in terms of jobs than traditional forms of stimulus. So things have completely changed in the last decade since the last financial crash. And I hope, as government is formed now in Ireland, that kind of research that's really well put together will inform some of the thinking about a new programme for government. I don't think it's good enough to say we don't have the money to do things. We know we have to borrow. And unfortunately, it is the case that governments everywhere are going to have to borrow. It's what you then do with that borrowing, and doing it and investing in the right way in multiple problem solvers has been done before. And we have learned really good lessons from previous crises that we now need to do. And fundamentally, it is the case that the large economic assets in every city tend to be, and certainly it is the case in Dublin and in Belfast, tend to be near ports, and sea level rises are happening and they are a reality. And we have a decision now about the type of climate resilient infrastructure that we need to build. And if we don't do it, we will be asked 10 years from now why we didn't use this crisis as an opportunity to invest in the right way.
Ian, when I tweeted this morning that we were going to be talking about the Leaving Cert and the predictive grades, a couple of tweets came in immediately, and a lot of people were saying that this will hit this year's fifth years the hardest, because when all of this kicked off, you know, Leaving Certs by and large had already got their curriculums finished, you know, with a few exceptions, but next year's pupils will have had a few months of remote learning, which won't quite tick the same boxes, and they're probably going to find themselves competing for fewer college places, because there'll be so many people this year who will get their points but won't get them in time, that next year students could be hit on the double. And that hardly seems fair.
Yeah, no, absolutely it doesn't. And I think that's one of the reasons why on Friday, when we welcomed the conclusion to the uncertainty for this year's Leaving Cert students, I think it was just an untenable kind of situation for them to continue to wait until June for clarity on how this whole thing was going to work at the end of July. It was just causing so much stress and anxiety. And we were seeing it through our text line in terms of the real and serious kind of stress and anxiety. And I think a lot of people play it down or were attempting to play that anxiety and that stress down. But I think we have to all remember that when you're going into the Leaving Cert, it is built up as one of the most formative things you'll ever do. Lots of people talk about how it was the most difficult set of exams, you know, even in comparison to further third level exams. So something had to change. And on Friday, when we were welcoming this, firstly, we welcomed the element of choice, because I think it is useful to have students give the option of either selecting the calculated grades or waiting to sit the exams at a later date. But you're right, that could have a knock-on impact for the fifth year students that are currently studying at present. And so what we were saying on Friday is that in addition to all of the changes that are being made for this year's cohort, we need to have an additional allocation of college places across all courses, both this year and next year, to be able to ensure that we're not disadvantaging the fifth year students that are coming behind them.
Is that at all possible, though? Because you could have a situation where, in fact, college courses this coming September or even a year down the line will have to have even reduced numbers. Because if, I mean, I went to UCD and I remember Theatre L used to be able to fit 600 people when it was full. Now those theatres are only going to be able to house about 50 people. So actually, there's probably a case to be made that courses are going to have fewer people admitted to them this year and next rather than more.
I think if you look at there's two things to that. Number one, in terms of the international student cohort, I assume that that will be massively down this year and next year based on the international travel restrictions that are going to be in place. And that will obviously be a massive issue for third level institutions to deal with in terms of the income impact that that will have. But secondly, I think third level education lends itself much better to the remote learning than perhaps the second level, where it's much more engaged learning between the teacher and the student. I think that you will be able to run courses online for a particular period, whether that's 6 or 12 months, and not really affect the quality of learning. As we all know, higher education learning is very different to second level, and much of the balance and the burden is on the student to actually acquire the learning outcomes and obviously attend the lectures for kind of the overall framework to the syllabus of the course. So I do think that there will be possible ways to adapt the third level learning environment to accommodate the increase in numbers of students. And obviously, all of that will require lots of smart thinking by all of our colleges and universities, which I don't think it's beyond to make that happen and to make that work. The other key thing for us as well is that obviously this process is somewhat opaque still at the moment. And I think the calculated grade system needs to be very transparent and everyone needs to be very able to clearly understand it. Particularly because obviously there's been a lot of concern around the use of potentially school indicators and how that's going to impact disadvantaged students more than perhaps some of their more advantaged counterparts.
Yeah, so I asked this question at the weekend, and Joe McHugh said that he was still satisfied that if you were, you know, if you went to a perceived weaker school but you were a good student, that you'd already have an academic record to back that up, and that they were satisfied that the algorithm would still produce a good grade for that person. But I did make the point to them, and they did accept that any system at all, which to some degree factors in the previous performance of your school, is always going to punish some good students and reward some poor ones.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously it can go conversely the other way as well. So I guess, like, you know, there is a lot of concern just about how that bell curve will be applied at the departmental level and what that impact will have potentially on individual students' grades. It's all very well and good to say that you want to have, you know, a similar distribution of grades per school, but how does that impact individual students? And I think for us particularly, we're concerned about those students who will have had less impact, less access to teaching over the last number of months. And I think a lot of people article as well. There's been confusion over the predicted nature of the grade in that, you know, a lot of people are jumping straight to the fact that it will be a composite of previous grades instead of potentially, you know, factoring in the potential of a student between the mock exams and the actual exams. Everyone normally makes some sort of improvement between those two sets of exams. And is that going to be a factor in the decision? I think that that needs to be clarified as well, because a lot of people are just assuming that they're going to get the mock grade, which obviously some people are somewhat distressed about. So I do think that, you know, as well as all of that, we have to allocate additional places at third level courses as well for access students. So students who would be from non-traditional backgrounds that may be able to get into particular courses based on their performance, and then also have additional supports. But I think, to be honest with you, the whole thing needs to work very well, because, you know, if you're thinking of Leaving Cert applied students, if you're thinking of students who are sitting the Leaving Cert who are going to go directly into the world of work, and that was always their plan, you know, there's not as much wiggle room for them to be able to deal with some sort of kind of, you know, more opaque Leaving Cert. They need to have a qualification that stands the test of time for them to be able to rely upon, whether it's now and getting a job, or whether it's later on when they want to rely upon that qualification to get into to further education as well.
It will be interesting to see whether the department does actually publish the algorithm, because they said there's going to be no subjective calls here when they get everything sent back to the department. There will be some mathematical formula that which will spit out everyone's grades. I wonder, will they publish that when the time comes? Grainne, one thing that strikes me though about the Leaving Cert is that while everyone wanted the candidates to have some certainty to know that the exams wouldn't be going ahead in their traditional format this summer, that with all of the doubts now about exactly how the grade will be calculated, about how an appeal will be lodged, about whether they'll get into college in time, that maybe the government has actually created more uncertainty than they've eliminated.
Well, look, this was always going to be the case. I mean, you can't do both. So in other words, as soon as the government said, look, you know, there's a decision that we are taking and here's the decision, then unless they had absolutely everything sorted, then it was going to create uncertainty. So I have actually a huge amount of sympathy for the decision makers on this one, as well as, of course, for the public and for the young people who are most affected. And I think it is unfortunately the case that this is being played out in countries across Europe, all trying to make the same decisions. So I suppose, as has been already said by Ian, I think there are a number of things that are going to be critically important: transparency and good communication, and being honest with the public that not every question has been answered yet. And I think over time the public will accept that. Better to know some information, I think, in this instance, than to try and have a perfect picture. I think the second thing is, I think government's going to have to be clear that there will be some things that it will try, and unfortunately it will have to tweak. And because we're making big systemic changes very, very quickly. I think the third thing, and I expect this is the case, what has marked Ireland out from other countries over many years has been when it has a crisis, such as the financial crash and the recession last time around, it continued to invest in its young people and it continued to invest in skills relative to other countries. And I think that has enabled and ensured that Ireland has had a relatively agile recovery from the last financial crash. So it's really, really important that is sustained now and at the moment. So when other people talk about Ireland, and I work with countries who talk to me all the time about Ireland, and what has been amazing about Ireland's recovery has been the fact that they have invested in skills and in their young people. And so this is really, really unnerving for young people. Well, it's really unnerving for their parents.
Can I talk to you about investments in young people? Yeah. I don't mean to rush you along, but we're a little bit pressed for time. But I know that one thing which is being floated at the moment is the proposed abolition of the Department of Children and Youth Affairs, because Fianna Fáil in particular wants to create a new State Department of Higher Education, which would obviously be dealing a lot with the question mark about college admissions and college places and the likes. There's an argument to be made that the Department of Children and Youth Affairs could be retained but simply just have a minister who double ups, but then there's also the prospect of it being eliminated entirely. To your mind, what is the importance of having a standalone department with a standalone minister?
Well, it's absolutely critical. And I was flabbergasted, frankly, to find that there were even suggestions that this department could be changed or removed. Let's go back to why the department was set up in the first place. It was set up following systemic failures in how children were treated in Ireland over decades, when abuse, unfortunately, was meted out onto children and young people, where their voices weren't heard and where policy did not reflect the needs of young people. To find that quickly, a decade on, we could start to think immediately about removing that department. The department has been successful, but it's really only getting going. You don't change systemic failures in a number of years. So the department needs to stay, and it needs to stay because it needs to recognise that children are more than about education. They are fully formed, fully functioned human beings that need public policy to reflect what they need. And I think when we look back over this recession, and we will recover from it, what we need to look back on is what were some of the things that we did and did well. And I think investing now in young people, in skills and in their future, will be the difference between Ireland being in a very good place in a number of years and not being so. And I think, you know, even the suggestion that you would change the department would be a failure on my part, and a failure, I think, of what has been a very successful move to put children at the heart and at the centre of public policy at cabinet level. There are other countries who look to Ireland, you know, with envy and say what a good job they've done for their children and young people, and they're building on it. It's not perfect. But let's not pull the rug under this one when it has been a success.
Ian Power, in a couple of sentences, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you only need to look at what was there previously, where the youth affairs element was subsumed in the Department of Education, and the children element was subsumed in the Department of Health, and neither really were able to get a look in, you know, from a systemic perspective. I think if you only think about the fact that it's the sixth highest spending department, the work that TUSLA is required to do, and the fact that the expansion of the childcare system has been so dramatic, and that probably we will expect to see that expansion required even further given the current circumstances, the need for a new youth strategy, which still is on the agenda, and the fact that youth participation has been so much strengthened by the department, I think it would be unconscionable to remove both the department or to double up jobs at a cabinet level for a minister.
We'll wait and see exactly what comes out of the talks. In the meantime, guys, we will let you go. Thank you very much for joining me this morning. Gráinne Long, who's the former CEO of the ISPCC, now Commissioner for Resilience with Belfast City Council, and Ian Power, who's the Chief Executive of Spunnet.ie. Thanks very much for joining me.